So there's a lot going on in this topic, and we're in 1 hour are not going to cover everything by any stretch of the imagination. If you see the links I gave you at the top of the sheet, so the first link there is a share that I gave 7 years ago, which really focused, for the most part, on some of the halachic issues of machine matzah. And can you make a show? The machine, your shaliach for kavanah lishmas and things like that. It did more of the even than we're going to see here. The other three sources that I gave you there, the middle two are interesting historical articles on the introduction of machines for making matzah. The first one in America, and then the second one, the JSTOR article more broadly. And then the last one is cool. It's a patent that the Manischewitz family filed for their machines for making matzah. So it was actually very funny because initially when I went looking for it, I had the patent number, but I didn't put in U.S. first. So I just put in the patent number, and I got a British patent by that number, and it was from a Jewish fellow. it was a very blatantly Jewish name, but it had nothing to do with matzah making, and I realized the mistake. Okay, so for centuries, people made their own matzah, as described in the Gemara. Centuries, millennia, people made their own matzah. Over time, this evolved into a communal baking process in which needy people were hired to do the work for the community, and they were supervised by the oh-so-lucky rabbi of the community, because that's what he needed to do before Pesach, was to supervise the production of matzah. I gave you the basic sources here on the steps for making the matzah. So first of all, we read it yesterday in Parshas HaChodesh, Ushmartem es hamatzos, right? You shall guard the matzos. So the Gemara has a debate as to what exactly that means. What does guarding the matzah mean? Does that mean once it's made into matzah, heaven forfend? Absolutely not. You have to start sometime before that. The only question is how far back? Sorry?
You're worried they're going to steal the matzah.
Well, you're worried it's going to become chametz, which seemed to be the concern. And so once baked, that's less of an issue, unless you have a gebrach concern, which is a whole other discussion. But per the Gemara that you see in source number 2, they're actually guarding it from the time of Ketira, from the time that the wheat is cut. There's no fear that the water falling on the wheat when the wheat is growing in the field is going to make it matzah, which is a good thing, because that would really change the way we have matzah. We wouldn't. But here, the Gemara talks about B'tzeko shal nachrim adam emale kreso mehen. Dough that's been kneaded by non-Jews, you can have as much of that as you want at the Seder. But you need to have an olive-sized amount of matzah at the end. Meaning you can't fulfill matzah's mitzvah with the matzah that they needed. My time, why? Because they don't guard the matzah. I'm not going to go into here the discussion of what qualifies as shimur. A Jew, a non-Jew, a video camera, or shimur lishma. Those are all fun and interesting topics. But beyond the scope of what we're going to do right now, my point in bringing this is only to emphasize that it's guarded from some early stage. And in fact, the machlokas is, does it have to be guarded from the time of Ketzira, the time of harvesting, or from the time of Lisha, from the time that you knead the dough? We're going to come back to that in a little bit.
It's only a question for the mitzvah of matzah?
For the mitzvah of matzah. In other words, it isn't that it's not matzah if it hasn't been guarded all along. It's that it's not matzah for the sake of the mitzvah at the Seder. Correct. Ushmartem es hamatzos. It doesn't become chametz by definition. Just because of a lack of shmira. I am out of my hard copies. This is my last one. I sort of need it. I've been spoiled by people bringing e-devices. So the wheat is supposed to be guarded fairly early on, and the water that you use, this is a classic Gemara, I didn't bring you the classic part of it, I just brought you the part that's most relevant for us, is Mayim Shalanu. The source number 3, the Gemara, also Msacham Amr of Yehuda, Isha lo talush ela b'mayim shalanu. A woman should only knead the dough using Mayim Shalanu, Shalanu from the word lun, to remain overnight, meaning water that was drawn from the river yesterday, and then was kept outside of the river overnight. And the classic part of the Gemara is that one of the Amoraim teaches this in public, and then the next day everybody comes to him and says, "We want your water." because they think Mayim Shalanu means our water. You can only make matzah using our water. So everybody dutifully shows up to get their water. But that's not what it means. It means water that remained out of the body of the river. The fear is that the water that is in the river is warmed up in the course of the night, and that will make it bad for making for kneading the dough, because it will make it become chametz sooner. Do not ask me why it will be warmer. It will be warmer.
Overnight.
It will be warmer, yes. So water that warmer than the water that you stored. So because of that, you use the water that was actually drawn the day before and remained out of the resource overnight. And of course, the most famous part is the idea of the 18 minutes. So all the dough, not all the dough, all the processing is supposed to occur from the time of exposure to water till the end of the baking within 18 minutes to avoid generating chametz. If you take a look at source number 4, the Mishnah talks about how to tell whether your dough has become chametz. We have signs for chimutz. In other words, leavening is a discernible state, at least theoretically. I say theoretically because I need to know, so what are the signs I'm supposed to look for? But the transformation should be a visible transformation, but not all dough will actually display the signs of leavening. So they talk about here, batzek hacheres, as Rashi reads it, dough that is tough like pottery, and therefore you don't really see the bloating, you don't see the cracking that would be associated with rising. So what do I do? So the Mishnah says, im yesh kayotze bo shehech mitzhareza asur. If I have other dough, which was started at the same time, and endured the process and is already becoming chametz, then that means that this dough is considered chametz also, even though it's not showing signs of being chametz. So I have two pieces of dough that I worked with. I made two loaves. One loaf is showing signs of chimutz. The other loaf is showing nothing. It's hard. So I can assume that just like the first one is now chametz, the second one is chametz as well. So the Gemara asked in source number 5, what do you do if you don't have any other dough to compare it with? Now what do you do? Im ein sham kayotze bo mahu. What if there isn't another piece of dough that you can use for comparison? So Amar Rabbi Avo, Amar Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, kedei she'elech adam yimigdal nunya l'Tveria mil. He says it's the length of time that it would take you to walk from Migdal Nunya to Tveria, which is a mil. So the Gemara asks, so why didn't you just say a mil? Well, who cares about Migdal Nunya? To which the answer is, because it's important for you to know that too, that the length of a meal is the distance from Migdal Nunya to Tveria. There is a nice machlokas as to what exactly the length of time is that it takes, you know, to walk a meal. It becomes relevant not just for this, but for davening times. And we generally go with 18 minutes as our time, although really it's not so clear cut that it should be 18 minutes. Nonetheless, that's what we work with.
Are the other shiurim longer or shorter?
So there are some that are longer, like 24 minutes and so on, yeah.
What's a mil converted into kilometers?
Basically a kilometer. It's 2,000 amos, so it depends on how large you view a tefach. But if you take Ramosha's tefach is 3.6 inches. So if you multiply that out, that's 21.6 inches for an amma, multiply that by 2,000 and you have a mil converted into centimeters and you get roughly a kilometer.
No, it doesn't. Really, it doesn't.
I mean, it shouldn't take you. If it does, you're out of shape, and you need to do some work. The discussion in the Gemara is based on the discussion that we showed him. I should say is based on the Gemara later on in Pesachim that talks about the distance it takes to travel when the sun is setting. How far you could travel during the day, and then how far you could travel after sunset before the stars come out. And if you want, I can send you sources on that. It's a fun discussion. But yeah, it actually may be longer than 18, not shorter. So go figure. And if you wanted to do the math on there, you could. But it's basically a kilometer is a meal. So the last point in this introduction is source number 6. Which, you know, I said that it has to be guarded, that everything is supposed to be guarded. So here's the idea that it's supposed to be l'shem matzas mitzvah, source number 6 from the Gemara Masechta Daf Mem. Amar lahu lahanu de mahaf chikipi. Rava said to the people who were in charge of flipping the stalks when they would bundle the stalks out in the field, have the mitzvah in mind when you are doing that. Alma kasavar shimur meikara mitchilasavet sofa ba'inan, which indicates that watching the matzvah and doing it the shei matzas mitzvah is already when you're processing it in the field. It isn't sufficient to do it mishas lisha at the time of kneading the dough. It has to be even when you cut the grain. So all of that is the basic process that was done for a very, very long time. Once you introduce mechanization, you have halachic concerns. Because they understood, going back to the days of the Gemara, they understood the basics of fermentation, meaning they understood that sugar is converted, right? Sugar is converted into energy. You learn chemistry? Hopefully. Sugar is converted into energy. It leads to production of carbon dioxide as well as ethanol, which makes your bread kind of fun to eat. The focus here is the carbon dioxide, not the alcoholic content of your bread. The gas is held in place by the protein structure in the dough, and therefore the dough rises, right? As gas is produced, the gas is trapped within the structure of the proteins in the dough. For a longer discussion of this, you can go back to a discussion which we recorded on YU Torah a couple of years ago on the science of chametz and a presentation that we did at Netivot or at Olpana. I forget which one was the one that we recorded. Okay. But the problem is that there's a lack of scientific clarity regarding the specifics of fermentation. Meaning, I understand that something is happening to the sugars in the dough and it's leading to the production of a gas and therefore this thing is rising. But I don't know all the specifics of how that works. I don't. But aside from that, they didn't. And therefore you have questions of what happens if you introduce new materials? Instead of having somebody's hands work the dough, what if you use a metal bar to knead the dough? What if instead of the friction from people's hands, you have friction from the machines? Maybe that's going to cause fermentation to happen quicker. We don't know. Not to mention, if you use a machine, what's the logical result of your process? What happens to your process?
More efficient.
More efficient and faster. Right? Everything moves faster, which leads to questions about how well you'll be able to inspect what's going on. Can you watch a process like that, make sure there aren't crumbs of dough that are getting left behind or that are getting into the corners and that you could have a problem with? Not to mention, you run into another problem. This happens, I don't know if any of you give blood, but they took a step towards speeding up blood donations. But it's the sort of classic problem. When you have a three-step or four-step process and you speed up step one, does that help you overall?
Depends which is the slowest step.
It doesn't matter. Fundamentally, if you only speed up step one, you're just going to have a backlog when you get to step two. They introduced this thing called a Q-pass, right? Where instead of having to sit there while somebody reads you 40 questions and you answer no, 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 yes, no, 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 instead you fill it out online that morning, you print it out, and you bring that to them. And then they can scan it, and that's great. That's step one. But you still have to go through the thing where they prick your finger and check for iron, and they're still going to ask you certain questions that they want to ask you and see your reaction to. And then you still have to wait until there's a bed available. So therefore, you sped up step one, and that just means that your backlog is now at step two instead of at step one. That's all you've succeeded in doing. So too with the machines. There's a big concern when they start using machines, and you'll be surprised at how early mechanization begins. It's not the 19th century. It's the 13th century. But they run into problems because you're able to knead the dough and knead large amounts of dough, but you're not getting any faster at putting it into the oven. And the result is that you have stuff that's just sitting there unworked. And one of the key principles of the process of handling of the dough and making the matzah is that the reason why it won't rise is because you're handling it at all times. But now you're not, because you have downtime for the loaves that are just sitting there waiting to be able to get into the oven. So that's another concern. Plus, when you get to automation, there are questions of lishma, right? Is it enough that I push the button lishma? The machine didn't know I pushed the button lishma. So all of these are halachic. All of these are halachic considerations. But separate from the halachic considerations, we also have meta halachic concerns about economics and society. So all of these things are going to be relevant.
the
Is there a scientific explanation that scientifically does working the dough slow down the rising process? Like, how does that work?
Right. So I once tried to look into that question, whether actually handling the dough is going to do anything to slow fermentation. And I wasn't able to find anything that I felt like this is a definitive source that... Matzah does not use yeast, that is correct.
And then would that prevent the rising yeast?
No, because there's ambient yeast.
Okay.
If it were that simple, then life would be a lot easier.
But it makes it far less likely that it will rise also.
It makes it less likely, for sure.
Because you believe for a time it may not rise. Theoretically.
Hypothetically. What?
Isn't it just like a slower, lesser amount of rising?
No, fundamentally, you need an organism present in order to do fermentation.
Right.
So, you know, in a hypothetical, you know, clean room at NASA, right, where you've managed to get rid of everything, it won't, you know, you won't have to worry after 18 minutes because there's nothing there in order to do the fermentation.
You're worried about air,
ambient
air.
Correct. So the earliest machines, this was a great find. This is in the document, the third link that I gave you at the top of the page. This is a 70 or 80 page document, 70 page document called The Controversy Surrounding Machine-Made Matzot, Halachic, Social, and Economic Repercussions in the Hebrew Union College Annual in 2004. So they quote you a Meiri, which appears in two places. It appears in his Perush to Psachim and Chesam and Beis, but in much greater length in Magen Avos Tezayin, which is what I brought you and translated for you here in source number 7. Take a look at what he describes. I'm going to go with the English just in the interest of time in order to be able to cover as much of the material as we can. Another local practice of ours and of our ancestors and masters of blessed memory is to knead the dough of Pesach with an amla. Amla is Ayin Mem Lamed He. La'amol. Amal is? To work. Strain. Struggle. Right. So this amla that they're using is essentially nothing but a long metal pole. That's really what it is. So women are present according to the amounts, I think it's the amounts of water, for mixing the dough and baking. And after it is mixed according to their number, they then combine the pieces of dough on the amla. So what you're doing is the women are doing lisha. They're mixing the flour and the water. They've now created pieces of dough. They put them there. It says on in the Hebrew, it's al. But it doesn't sound like it. It's like really, it's like it's beside the amla. And a strong person guides the amla over the dough with great strength from one end of the dough to the other. It's a roller. Instead of individual people kneading the dough, now you have a big pole. It can do a lot of the dough at the same time. Without a doubt, the force of the amla is more effective to knead a large amount of dough than is one woman with a little dough. It's even better, even though it's doing a lot more dough, the amla is more effective with a lot of dough than individual is with a little dough. And one of the women stands near the amla, and the one guiding it, and continuously collects the crumbs of dough which fall, because you're worried that they are going to be left behind there, and they'll become chametz if they sit there, and then they'll get mixed into the next batch. And they continuously scrape the amla pole so that no dough sticks to the amla pole. The main reason to do this is that it greatly reduces the amount of water needed. In other words, if you want to knead the dough well, you need it to have a certain malleability, a certain flexibility. And if individuals are going to do it, you need a lot of water. But if you use the amla pole, it isn't so much the speed as it is you don't need as much water and you can still maintain the same speed that you would normally have, he says. Also, he says, this is fascinating, they're concerned about the heat from their hands, meaning your hands are warming up the dough through friction, and it is better for them to knead the dough with the amla pole, which is cold. It's an interesting idea.
Then he would pass from the dough onto the pole.
Well, the fear that they have, it will. That's the way heat works, by transfer from warm to cold. But the idea is that it's actually less likely to cause chimutz. The pole is less likely to cause chimutz than their hands are.
You might talk about people with wipes on the hands, right?
Correct.
They're mechav into the second law of thermodynamics.
Correct. So our ancestors did in Narbonne and Carcassonne and other local cities and in France and Germany on the council of their leaders and rabbis. So he says, we've been doing this for a long time. And even though the Talmud states one should not mix at once more than the amount for which one separates a tithe, meaning the amount that triggers hafrashas challah, still, via the amla and the methods we have outlined, there is no need for such a limit. It's okay that we're dealing with large quantities. Never has any dough become like pottery or begun to blow, right? The batzei kacharas that we talked about, or the concern that it's starting to become chametz, indicating that leavening was near. And yet, he says, nonetheless, the people he's addressing here have said, we don't think this is a good idea. Still, when those students saw this, they spoke ill of us out of concern that it may be chametz, as there's a significant time lapse between the kneading of the first loaves and the last. That concern that I mentioned before, you now have a backlog. So they argued, the Talmidim argued it's no good, and what they did was they got a very big oven and they threw everything into the oven at once. And the Meiri says, that's great, if you can do that, that's great, but we don't have large ovens like you do, and I still think this is the best way for us to be making to be making matzah. So this is your first example of mechanization of any kind, and you can see the concerns that go into anything you're doing that changes from the old practice. Yeah.
Jay. Or this, the kneading was done only by hand, or was also like what was it called? Those rollers.
Like, so it sounds like they're doing it by hand.
Everything was just by hand, like not even the smaller rollers.
Correct. That's what it makes it sound like. Right. Yeah. I don't know. It's an interesting historical question. When was the rolling pin introduced?
Right. It would be before this gigantic.
I would think, but I don't actually know the history of the rolling pin. Okay.
I imagine they used
worth looking
pots
into
beforehand. Like they would just take a pot and roll things.
Why?
Because if you didn't have the concept of a rolling pin and you needed something round that would flat and have dough, a pot works nicely.
That assumes your pots are round.
They had round pots.
I mean,
historically speaking, we've seen round pots.
That's true. That's true. Although, if you're talking about a pottery one, a clay one, it's probably hard to clean the surface.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's still easier than rolling the dough by hand.
Yeah. So, that's the earliest stage of introducing any form of mechanical operation, and it's not even mechanical the way we think of mechanical. You don't get to automated mechanization until the modern age. What you get is, at the end of the 19th or the middle of the 19th century, you get mechanical rollers that are used to flatten the dough, and then it falls into a tray, and the tray rolls into the oven. And then, over time, various improvements are added, and the roll is expanded. It starts out in the late 1830s in Western Europe. There's a fellow by the name of Isaac Singer in France. It's approved by the local rabbis at that point. They're good with it in Western Europe. And then in the 1840s, Rav Hamburg of the yeshiva in Firth appeals to Rav Yosef Shaul Nathanson, the Shaul Meshiv, and he says it's good. The Tiferes Yisrael approved it. And it spreads in the 1850s to New York City, in the 1880s to Cincinnati, with the approval of Ber Menashevitz, who branches off from Shchita into matzah. And we're going to come back to him later on. But in the beginning, there really is no issue. The controversy starts when this practice spreads to Eastern Europe in the late 1850s. That's when this really becomes an issue, and it's fought out in that point. It's fought out again at the end of the 19th century. And even still today, there are those who are who oppose it. But the reasons are fascinating. So first of all, why does this appeal? When you get to the automated one, forget the one in the Meiri's day, why is it better for me to use a machine?
Precision, mass production.
Lowers the price.
Cheaper. Right? Mass production means I can produce more. The community needs more matzah. Just that it's a growing community in the United States, certainly, at that point, and they need it.
You can know exactly, like, what's the matter, exactly how long it's been in production for. Like, this month is 12 minutes to make, and they all need 12 minutes to make.
Right. So your production value, so to speak, and the technology that plays into it are much more precise, yeah? Not to mention, except Sofer says, and we'll talk about this more later, that he's been having difficulty finding good workers. Except Sofer, right, son of the Chasim Sofer, is not the first person I would have thought of to embrace the mechanization of and the automation of making matzah. But he says, we don't have good workers. So he goes to check it out and to see, well, maybe we need this. But it takes particular hold in the U.S. And here I brought you a quote from Professor Sarna in his article, How Matzah Became Square. And that's the one that I brought you in the second link on the sheet from Brandeis. You can find it there. His history is of matzah, machine matzah in the United States. So he points out a few factors. He points out that the Hasidic communities in the United States were weak at the time, and the Hasidim tended to be the opponents of machine matzah. The rabbis had few alternatives for matzah, and therefore they tended to the side of leniency. But he says a lot of it is about American consumer values. in number 8. He says, in Anglo-Jewish newspapers, the community described its matzot, the company described its matzot, as being in all ways superior to the competition. They were produced in what the company called, quote, a temple of kashrut, a palace of cleanliness, a gigantic structure of steel and glass, overflowing with light, air, and sunshine. Yes. Well, as opposed to the way they used to make it, which is historically, and I as a kid went to the Schatzer Matzah Bakery in Brooklyn, and then years later went to buy matzah every year, and it's underground, shielded from the light. You're afraid of sunlight potentially affecting the process if an area is heated up by light from the window. So they're saying, no, we do this out in the open, in a overflowing with light, air, and sunshine. In other words, they met the highest American food and health standards. They were, in their own way, therapeutic. Matzah is therapeutic. Indeed, the Rambam, rolling in his grave, the Rambam said that matzah is the least healthy bread you can imagine. It doesn't change the chiyuv to eat it, but that's what he writes in his medical advice. Because for the Rambam, the essence of medicine is digestion. That's the Rambam is the biggest issue, and unfortunately matzah doesn't have it. So the Rambam is down on the medical aspects of matzah. Well, here it is therapeutic. Indeed, Menashevitz advertised at one point that, quote, no human hand touches these matzahs in their manufacture, as if this fact, rather than the production of matzah by hand, reflected Judaism's highest precept. It's better that no one's touched it. By appealing to modern American consumer values to sell their traditional food product, the company implied that purchasers of Menashevitz matzah could subscribe to the highest values of both Judaism and America. So that's the appeal of it. There are some very interesting side things that happen along with this, such as the squaring, like you've seen in the Sarna title, the squaring of matzah is actually part of this.
Imagine it's because they just make a big thing and they just cut it?
So it's actually because they needed to make sure that they didn't lose crumbs in the machine, and the easiest way was not to do any cutting. That's, if I remember correctly, that's the way it worked. Because the edges that you cut from the circles wouldn't be reclaimable, lest they become chametz. This also impacts other debates about mechanization, like making tzitzis strings with machines. So, despite, the therapeutic matzah, there's a lot of opposition. Rav Chaim of Sanz, Rav Shlomo Kluger in Brod, numerous Hasidish Rebbeim, quoted by the Avnei Nezer, were very against. Some of their opposition was halachic, concerns that it becomes chametz, concerns that it won't qualify as matzah's mitzvah, like we talked about. And some of their concerns are meta-halachic problems, such as we'll see, support for the aniyim, for the paupers who have been hired to work in manufacturing matzah. They're now out of work, because that's what happens. It's not a Luddite argument. It's an economics argument.
Well, that's the Luddites. It's a machine that's taking away our jobs.
That wasn't the origin of Luddite opposition, was it?
Yeah, they're destroying factories that were creating, that were weaving better fabrics or whatever, and handmade stuff, so they were burning those factories.
I didn't realize it started with economics. I thought that was a later period. Okay, cool.
Could be there's an earlier origin.
Yeah, I don't know. Okay. And then there was concern about the Haskalah. This is, the Haskalah is thriving in Western Europe and making inroads in the East, and the concern is that this change reflects an invasion by the Haskalah. If you take a look at the Avnei Nezer in source number 9, he writes to a community that had fired the rabbi. The rabbi had banned machine matzah. So the community fired the rabbi. So the Avnei Nezer is very unhappy. He says, and again, I'm going to stick with the English just in the interest of time, the rabbi of your community came to me with a great complaint, for they cheated him of his livelihood and reduced his established salary and did other things, all because he prohibited machine matzah. I inform you that this is very evil in my eyes, the permission of machine matzah as well as the attack on the rabbi for prohibiting it. Therefore, I warn you strongly to return the rabbi as he was and to nullify the evil practice of machine matzah. That's what he says. The Ves Haminaka Raham Meham Machine Matzos Tivat. That's what he says. You will atone for the sin of the past and receive great reward from heaven for the future. So, let's talk through the opposition to the machine matzah. So, part of the opposition is on grounds that it might actually be chametz. And this goes back to a point I made in the beginning. Fear that the machines actually generate more friction, making it chametz faster. So I brought you Shlomo Kluger in Aleph Lecha Shlomo in source number 10. He says, further, I believe the machine's friction causes heat. Dochak ha-machine. Heating the dough via the great friction, and that's an entirely bad effect. That's number one. Number two, he's concerned about the backlog. All this dough that's sitting there waiting to go in, and even if you'll say that from beginning to end it's still 18 minutes, it's the same objection that the Talmidim voiced to the Meiri. The dough is not being handled all this time, and therefore it potentially becomes chametz, even though 18 minutes have not passed. Not to mention, there's a second element of this, which is maybe when we say that dough that's being worked by hand only becomes chametz in 18 minutes, maybe dough that's being worked by machine doesn't have that same 18 minutes. Take a look. It's source number 11.
Argument, though, because you're kneading it by hand, your hands are going to be warmer than the ambient air. So you're putting heat into the dough. So if you're arguing that leaving it alone is okay, but the machine is creating heat, why isn't the hand creating heat?
Well, see, part of the problem here fundamentally, and I don't have an answer for the following question, is are we concerned about rising or are we concerned about fermentation? Because if you're going to tell me I'm concerned about fermentation, then you can tell me that working the dough shouldn't slow anything down. But if you're going to tell me that I'm concerned about rising, so every time I crush the protein structure by folding and refolding and pressing the dough, I am actually preventing it from rising.
Why isn't the friction doing that also? Friction's going to damage the outside layer of the dough.
Friction is going to damage the outside layer. Yeah, but the inside of it is where it's inflating.
Thin, though.
I mean, that's the crushing. That's not a function of the friction. Take a look at what he has here. He says in number 11, there will be a need for extra care with machine matzah. First, because who knows whether being worked by a machine prevents fermentation. Maybe, unlike your hands, working it doesn't slow it down. We have only found in the authorities that hand working does so. Who can gauge this natural phenomenon? Who can figure out? Who understands fermentation anyway? That's a concern. He says, I don't know that this works, and people are not going to be sufficiently careful. We have a principle in the Gemara Pesachim Daf Lamed Vav, which I didn't bring here on the sheet, but we have a principle that says that when you're dealing with matzah made for Pesach, since everybody is making their own matzah, in the days of the Gemara, everybody is making their own matzah, there's a concern that people are not zaris, people are not really that careful and energetic about watching it. They're talking about the difference between in the Beis HaMikdash, certain leniencies in making the matzah for Menachos, that you don't have when it comes to making matzah for Pesach. So the concern is applied here. Who's to say that everybody is going to be careful with this matzah? And there are particular challenges posed by machines. The Gemara mentions that when you work dough by hand, it slows chimutz, but who's to say machines do the same, like we just said? Wheat kernels can get mixed into the dough and you won't see it, and they won't get baked well. But also, the machine needs really careful cleaning. And you see the Sanzer, the Divrei Chaim, in number 12. He says, Dai les or vazet, sufficient to prohibit this, based on what Rav Mordechai Zev wrote, that he personally saw it is impossible to scrape off the stuck-on dough properly, that you can't scrape off the dough from this machine. This was this fellow, Mordechai Zev, was a businessman who saw it in Hungary and then reported back to the Sanzer what he had seen. The Ksav Sofer had a similar concern. The Ksav Sofer said it definitely needs a lot of cleaning, particularly on the parts that puncture the matzah, because the dough can easily get stuck to it. So part of the opposition is this stuff could actually be chametz. It's rare to find anybody who will actually hold today that machine matzah is chametz, but that's one level of concern. Even if you're not concerned that it might be chametz, there is other concern. It might not qualify as matzah's mitzvah for the Seder. We said in the beginning that there's a need for kavana, l'shei matzah's mitzvah, right? Machines do not have kavana. Now, in response to this, I didn't bring it on your sheet, but in response to this, some quote the Rashba in Chulin Daf Yud Beis. The Re says that when you have an act that you can do via shaliach, via your proxy, then having somebody stand there with proper kavana while the shaliach does it might be sufficient. that might be sufficient. So maybe, they argue, you can have the shaliach do that. You're allowed to have a shaliach make matzah that way. So maybe someone stands over the machine. He's an omid al gabav. He stands there, and he has proper kavana, and that's sufficient for the machine. You can see the obvious response to that, that at least a shaliach is capable of kavana. You know, the machine, there's no kavana at all. But you could read that argument either way. But that's one argument. A second argument is the issue of koach adam. Matzah's mitzvah requires, according to the Maharsham, who I brought you in number 13, requires human involvement. A human being has to actually make the matzah. So there are some who are lenient and say that's okay because there are some who are lenient and say it's okay because you're starting the machine. That's koach adam. That's your activity. But he argues that that doesn't work here. If you take a look at source number 13, he says one of the reasons why they prohibited this machine use, is because one may not fulfill the obligation at the Seder with matzah that is generated automatically and not by human action. It is as though the matzah had been generated by a mentally incompetent person. However, others have testified that the machine is powered by people who turn a wheel, and their force is not interrupted, such that the force would be considered an indirect effect, meaning they generate the electricity by having people turn a wheel. I don't know if you saw about a hydroelectric thing, and people are actually turning the wheel instead of having the water turn the wheel, or they release the water that powers the wheel.
It could just be a hand crank machine?
Maybe it could be, yeah. The argument for some is that this will be effective. He does not like the idea. There's a lot of discussion about this, about the person, you know, starting a machine by pushing a button, but on the other hand, maybe what you're doing then is you're completing a circuit, but that just means you're removing an obstacle to the electrical flow. Rather than actually generating something.
You have to pay for the electricity, so you're providing that.
Right, it's a paying for it doesn't really count, no. He argues that maybe starting the kneading going, starting the machine, and then putting the dough into the machine would suffice. And you put it in, and it's your action. But even if we would specify for people and say, okay, so don't use this matzah for the Seder. Use it for the rest of Pesach. Right? Manufacture all that you need for your other days of eating matzah. There's still a concern, or Shlomo Kluger is concerned, that even if we'll be careful not to use it for matzah's mitzvah, some people might think that they can. Right? This happens all the time. Right? When you have all those warnings on egg matzah boxes, right? About the elderly and the infirm, whatever. Who really understands that? The thing, look, that looks like a hashgach. Okay, fine. There are an awful lot of people who don't, they aren't up on the ins and outs of what the issues of egg matzah are. And they just assume kosher for Passover is kosher for Passover, and therefore, of course, I can use it for my Seder even. The Maharsham did not necessarily agree with this. The Maharsham said we don't make new gezeiros, and I gave you an example in source number 14 from the Yerushalmi, a principle that we don't make new gezeiros. But these were some of the halachic reasons for opposition. It may become chametz. Right? Whether because of the mechanization process or because the speed of it makes it difficult for us to clean it properly and so on. And even if it doesn't become chametz, it may not qualify as matzah's mitzvah. It's missing lishma, it's missing maisa adam, it can cause confusion for people. And then you get the opposition for meta reasons. Reasons that are not halachic in the way that we would usually think of halacha. The minhag is we don't use machines. We have never used machines. If you take a look at source number 15, you find the Abnei Nezer quoting the Ran, talking about the Gemara in Shabbos that talks about making a bris milah knife on Shabbos, in the whole debate whether you're allowed to do background steps to enable a mitzvah on Shabbos, to enable bris milah on Shabbos. So he says, in Rabbi Eliezer's community, Rabbi Eliezer was the one who permitted them to actually to do what they needed to do in order to make the knife for bris milah on Shabbos. So he quotes you, he says, in Rabbi Eliezer's community, they cut wood to make charcoal to prepare the milah knife on Shabbos. Even though the Chachamim were the majority against Rabbi Eliezer and the law follows them. How were they following Rabbi Eliezer? Still, they treated it as entirely permissible. And Rabbeinu Nissim deduced from there that certainly where the custom is to prohibit, based on the prohibiting view, it is as though they had accepted a prohibition for themselves and for all who would join them. Let me explain that a little bit better. If in Rabbi Eliezer's community, they're allowed to follow a minority view because the local rabbi has said, this is mutter, and therefore that's what we do, and therefore for all time in that city, they're allowed to say mutter, so how much more so if our practice has been to say asur, then it remains asur all along. We never used machines. Our minhag is not to use machines. Therefore, even if all the rabbis elsewhere say it's mutter,
how is it that we say if there's never an alternative?
Right. So the question is, does he mean the minhag was because we never had them, or does he mean that in the initial generation we opposed it and maybe that establishes the minhag? That's not clear to me. The other piece that I brought you that I find fascinating, and there's actually a mystical Torah on this, take a look at number 16 from Shlomo Kluger. Gam kol minhag Yisrael Torah me'olam havi matzos agulim v'lo merubaim. He says the custom has always been that we use round matzah rather than square. Ve'ata nasu matzos merubaim, and now they make them square. Ki agulim miyasher mikach haperum, they can't make it round because of the crumbs. So he says, how dare you make square matzah? Our minhag is to use round matzah. It sounds strange every time I read it, but look in the additional Torah on round matzahs and the symbolism on the shape of the matzah. But part of the opposition is that custom, part of it is economics, and this takes us back to the discussion about the Luddites, perhaps, and the needy people in general. With the Gemara in source number 17 talks about what you do to celebrate Purim if Purim occurs on Shabbos. When do you read Megillah? This is something called Purim Mishulash, which today can only happen in terms of Shushan Purim. If the 15th of Adar comes out on Shabbos in Yerushalayim, then you may have this issue.
Purim never falls on a Friday, though.
Sorry?
Purim never falls.
Sure, it does. Yep. Yes, it can. It happened several years ago. It's not that common, because when that happens, also the first day of Pesach ends up being a Sunday. And that has all sorts of interesting complications, but it does happen from time to time. It happened in 2001, happened in 2009, not sure about 2001, but happened in 2009, happened a couple of times, like not in a row, but in a span of a few years, and then it takes like 50 years for it to happen again. But in any case, the point is it can happen. So the Gemara Megillah says, we would not read the Megillah on Shabbos. Even though that's the day for reading Megillah, we don't read the Megillah on Shabbos. Why? So Rav Yosef says, because that's where the Aniyim all come to collect Matanos Levyonim. They come to Megillah reading in order to get Matanos Levyonim. You think that's a weird thing, that people circulate in Shul to come and collect? That's what Jews have done since clearly the days of the Gemara. So they say here that that therefore we don't want Megillah reading to be done on Shabbos because it's going to make it harder for the Aniyim to collect Matanos Levyonim. So Shlomo Kluger looks at that and he says, this is this work that people have, the jobs they're able to get making matzah is the most chitim for them. That's how they're able to afford Pesach. How dare you take their jobs away? To which Rabbi Yosef Shaul Nathanson says in source number 18, I'm sorry, I thought we were involved in the mitzvah of making matzah. He says, Iker ha'enyan lafos matzos. He says, the essence is to bake matzah in order to fulfill the obligation of matzah. What does this have to do with the aniyim? If one had many family members, so you could just bake matzah yourself, you didn't need to rely on the community matzah baking, would he be prohibited from baking personally without hiring aniyim to help him? Right? Because you're cheating them of their livelihood. You give maschitim. That's the response. But that's a second layer of meta concern. And then the big one was, where is this going to lead? And the concern for the Haskalah. Take a look at source number 19, Rosh Shlomo Kluger. He says, it doesn't appear to me that we should create new practices in our day under any circumstances. In this generation, all who add actually subtract, and the generation has not improved. Even had we no reason to prohibit, it would be appropriate to prohibit, for one should not create new practices these days. He says, even if I had nothing, no reason to oppose it on halachic grounds, doesn't make a difference. And he responds to the person who wrote to him. The person who wrote to him said, we ride the trains. How are we able to ride the trains? So he says, I'm shocked at his honor. How did he bring proof from the railroad for this machine? Why mention Shemitah beside Har Sinai? In optional matters, one may follow his wish. You want to take the train? Take the train. such as wearing whatever garb he chooses, right? Aside from, you know, hukozaku. But regarding mitzvos, we have only the custom of early authorities and our holy ancestors. Could one create a ritual talus with a different form that never existed? This is a mitzvah. Mitzvos remain the way mitzvos have always remained. That's the argument. Similarly, the Divrei Chaim said he didn't want them to use a steam mill to grind the wheat into flour, which initially they opposed because they felt, well, you're using a steam-powered mill, that means there's moisture in the air and that could get into the flour. So they did tests. They determined, no, it did not warm up the flour, it did not moisten the flour, but he said, nonetheless, this is a new thing, we don't want that. There was another concern. Some places may get bad machines. And then what are you going to do? The Gemara in Pesachim talks about this with Srike Baisus. I brought it for you in source number 20. The Baitos Ben Zonin is somebody who's involved in baking. And he had special molds for baking, such that he was able to make very pretty cakes and do it with great speed, and there's no concern for generating chametz. So the question was, would he be allowed to make it on Pesach? And the Chacham said, no, we will not allow you to make your cakes on Pesach. Why? Because other people make them and they don't have your machines. And we are concerned that, or your molds, whatever it was, and we are concerned that they will think it's mutter because you're making it. So the argument here is, even if the machines that are being used in one place are good, maybe other places will get bad machines. And then finally, this is a remarkable concern. This is also sort of quasi-economics as a concern. Rav Shlomo Kluger, in source number 21, he says, you know, if we're going to approve machines, right, and the machines are not done well, so there are some people who say, I want to do it by hand. They aren't going to be able to do it because there won't be enough people who want hand matzah to be able to hire workers to do it. You won't be able to afford it. Right? Right now, the whole community is getting hand matzah, so therefore we can hire people to do it. But how are you going to do it if it's just individual people here or there? They don't have the means of hiring anyone. So the opposition you have halachic opposition, als it's chametz, halachic opposition of it's no good for the Seder, and then the meta reasons of minhag, whether the minhag is we never did it, or just we never made it via machine, or we always made it round. You have the economics concerns, and you have the concern of where is this going to lead in terms of strengthening the hands of the reformers, in terms of some people getting bad machines, and even if your machine is good, their machine may not be good, and concern that if we approve these machines and they don't do well, then no one's going to be able to afford to do it by hand, and those of us who want hand matzah will not be able to get it. However, there were arguments in favor of the machines as well. Chief argument in favor of the machines is better a machine than a bad human worker. In other words, change happens when the current situation is untenable. And that was the point that the Ksav Sofer made in source number 22. He says, I didn't wish to inject myself into this. He's writing this in 1858. I didn't wish to inject myself into this. It's all new to me. I've never seen it. As a general rule, I withdraw my hand from creating novelties. Right? I have to. It's my trademark. However, times have changed in the past year, and Jewish workers are not found as they were in the past, and the workers we have are of the worst, bad and hasty. They don't listen to the supervisors. They've caused uncountable errors. Because of a lack of even people like these, I have needed to approve the use of non-Jewish workers other than for the matzah of the mitzvah, for the Seder. Because of all of this, after a great deal of persuasion, I agreed to have one machine brought here many weeks before the time to bake matzah to examine it and see its nature and its product. My court and I went to the bakery, we saw its deeds, and we stood for many hours until matzah were baked, and we agreed to bake with it when we saw that all was done with greater alacrity than with human workers, and it is possible to supervise the few workers involved. So he says, look, this is just, you know, it's a matter of necessity. By the way, I don't believe, you know, there is this sort of standard calumny of the Sofer family, the Chadash Hasim and Hatara and so on. They were a lot more creative than people give them credit for. You should learn more about the Hasim Sofer. I'm playing into it by saying this, and I shouldn't. But the argument that the Ksav Sofer makes is that this is simply a necessary thing to do. There's also a very interesting article. by Rabbi Dr. Slifkin in source number 23. This is off of his website. Bentley's Matzos and the Chumrah Machine, where he makes the argument that the comparison to the handmade Bentley is mistaken. There was a video that went around, as he notes, I think it was by Chabad, that said handmade is always better, right? Just like for the cars it's better, so too for the matzah. So... hopefully not. But he says, after the first paragraph there, he says, note that we're talking about a very small number of products with the cars, which are manufactured very slowly and carefully by dedicated craftsmen who are presumably being paid very well. The possibility of human error is therefore very small. Second, and more significantly, it's not as though machine-made cars are likely to involve errors in their manufacture. They are less likely to do so. Right? There's a reason why machines work to make cars. It's simply a matter of certain touches requiring fine motor skills that are better performed by hand. And note that certain parts of the Bentley manufacturing process which require uniform processes done with great precision in rapid time are done via machine. So he says the Bentley advantage is simply irrelevant when you're talking about matzah. It's worth reading the article. So some say better a machine than a bad human. However, others respond, no, just get better humans.
Are we defining bad human as incompetent or yes, as in like a bad person?
Incompetent, okay. More. So the argument in response is, as seen in the Avnei Nezer in source number 24, if you're going to permit it in one city, right, because you're afraid that you have bad workers there, then the result of that is going to be, even were their validity such a concern, would we tell a person to sin so that others would gain merit when dealing with a total violation in a matter which is very serious, meaning those who can get good humans are now going to use machines as well. And they're going to be sinning. Or as Shlomo Kluger wrote, the fact that you have bad workers in Germany doesn't mean we should permit this in Poland. That's his response. Others argued that you should be lenient to simply avoid worse. It's really part of the same argument, I suppose. And then others argued, that if you prohibit use of machines, then you're going to be motzilaz on all those Jews who use machines. Meaning the Gemara Gittin talks about someone who wanted to become authorized to be a shaliach for Gittin. And he wanted to have an extra level of caution that I outlined for you at the Gemara Gittin in source number 25 in preparing the get and in testifying that it was all done properly. And he was told not to. Because if you use this extra layer of caution, the result is going to be that people are going to say the Gittin that were delivered by others before that didn't have this layer of caution were all no good. To which the Sanzer responds, well, that may be true, but if people really are doing something wrong, then motzilaz. And of course you should say it's bad. That's the response of the Divrei Chaim. So, obviously you can see I'm summarizing a lot here. There's a lot that goes into the back and forth, but I wanted to hit the main points. But what's really interesting to see are the lengths that Manischewitz went to in the end of the 19th century into the early 20th to gain rabbinic support over these concerns. So one was, I mentioned the ads in the beginning in terms of getting popular support. But in 1938, they published a list of rabbis who supported the machine matzah, and I brought it to you in number 26. You see some of the names that are on that list, Rav Cook, Rav Meir Shapira, Rav Hildesheimer. You get a range of rabbis, the leaders of the Gudas HaRabbanim, that are all in support of Manischewitz matzah. But what's particularly fascinating, I saw it in the Sarna document, is source number 27. Case came in before the United States Tax Court in 1948. The Manischewitz family funded a yeshiva in Yerushalayim under their name, the Manischewitz Yeshiva, which was unusual. You didn't normally have, the Air Canada Center, the Manischewitz Yeshiva. But they did it, and their donations for the Manischewitz Yeshiva counted as a business expense. That's what they did. So the IRS says, what are you talking about? Why is that a business expense? They went to court and they won. They beat the IRS. Take a look.
Can you tie to that? They need to do research to ensure that our product is kosher.
No. Read number 27. Much of what I have described here would not be known, but for a 1948 case in the U.S. Tax Court, the case arose when the IRS challenged the right of the Manischewitz Company to deduct a payment made to Manischewitz Yeshiva as, quote, an ordinary and necessary business expense. It could not otherwise have deducted these payments since the Jerusalem Yeshiva did not qualify as a charitable organization under the tax code effect at that time. Manischewitz fought the tax collection agency's challenge challenge, and in so doing made the case that its donations to the yeshiva bore direct relationship to its business, having been made, as per the law, with a reasonable expectation of a financial return commensurate with the amount of the donation. In the course of the company's deposition, it frankly set forth some of the benefits that its philanthropy produced, including, as mentioned, that it helped to overcome the impression that American machine-made matzos are not kosher, and that it was beneficial in publicizing the company's product. Payments for the yeshiva, the company candidly concluded, have been made from combined religious, charitable, personal, and business motives, and the court solemnly agreed. Although there can be little doubt that the contributions to the seminary were prompted by a complex of motives, the precedent-setting decision declared the deduction was legal given that there were reasonably evident business ends to be served, and the intention to serve them appears adequately from the record. So they are
some smart Jews.
How long were they in court for this?
I don't know. I've not heard of it, but it's an interesting question. One last issue, which has its own beauty to it, I think is worth noting, and it's the sources that I brought you at the end there from the Mishnah Halachos. The Mishnah Halachos, Moshe Klein, points out that the Shulchan Aruch in Aruch Chaim Tassamach quotes the Rosh, that one should do the matzah baking himself, literally yourself by hand. And the Kaz quotes the Ari with the idea as well.
That leads to a lot of people screwing up.
Yeah, well, that's why we don't. But the idea of doing something by hand is fascinating. The Rokeach quotes it from a Mechilta in source number 28. We're told that when the Jews left Mitzrayim, they had Misharosam Tzuros Besim Losam Al Shechmam. Right? Their loaves were bound up in their clothing on their shoulders. So the Mechilta asked, Rabbi Nassan asked, what, didn't you have animals? They left Egypt without animals? We know they had animals. But they loved the mitzvah, and therefore they did it themselves to get schar for it. So writes the Medrash in this Mechilta. And therefore the Maharil also says that you should make it yourself. And he quotes the Gemara in Shabbos, which I brought you in source number 29, about what Amoraim did to prepare for Shabbos. They would singe the head of the animal themselves. They would salt the fish, they would light the candles, they braid the wicks, they clean the house, they chop it, whatever, all these things that you do yourself to prepare for the mitzvah, so you should do it yourself. Again, where you can. And the Ma'aril notes for you the Gemara Pesachim in source number 30, which talks about how you bake matzah, and it says, the Ani lights the fire, his wife does the baking, so too here, that's what you ought to do. You should manage, it's Lechem Oni, if you actually do it yourself, like an Ani would. So there is this element of chibuv hamitzvah, of love for the mitzvah, when you make it yourself, separate from the machines. But as Josh points out, that only works if you actually make kosher matzah. If you mess up your matzah, then you have chametz made with love. That's a bad idea. But hopefully this gives you a little bit of an introduction to the issues that surrounded the making of machine matzah. Shkoach.